KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
W Seattle.
We have to come to an agreement. We have to meet in the middle. That the mission of getting a bill done to strengthen America is more important than any of us clinging to a specific belief.
We knew how to behave at funerals and how to write short, melancholy poems about the passing of autumn that were exactly 17 syllables long.
You know, you listen to this music and it sounds like we're just sauntering down a country lane. But no, this is not a radio station for horse and buggy. We're on a jetliner today. You're listening to Weekday, a clip from Julie Otsuka and her novel, The Buddha in the Attic. She wasn't reading that, but that's her novel. And you heard Charles Schumer talking about immigration reform, which we're going to take up a little bit later in the program. Because first, we're going to take a look at what's happening in the skies, or perhaps, unfortunately, not what's happening in the skies. After more than a week of inspections, the battery manufacturer is off the hook as the culprit in the fires that have grounded the Boeing Dreamliner 787. A fire aboard a JAL 787 in Boston's Logan International Airport on January 7th. A smoke alarm aboard a plane flying over Japan on January 16th prompted the FAA to ground all Dreamliners in the United States. Other nations followed. One key question, what happened to the backup systems supposed to be in place in the event of electrical problems? And another, what will this do to Boeing? James Fallows has been thinking about it. He writes for The Atlantic magazine. He's author of China Airborne, about to come out in paperback. One of the things that China Airborne looked at was how other nations are going to learn from Boeing and its outsourcing approach to production. And, of course, that's one of the questions being asked about the Dreamliner. James Fallows, thanks for talking to us again. It's good to talk to you.
Steve, it's nice to talk to you. Greetings from the other Washington.
You got some snow there today?
It's beginning to melt, but anyhow, we survive.
All right. How bad are the Dreamliner's problems? You asked that question in your column, and I ask it to you.
I guess they seem a little worse now than they did 10 days ago or so when I was doing that that item, just because the Japanese authorities seem to have ruled out the easiest possible explanation, which is there was something wrong in a particular batch of batteries being produced in Japan by the subcontractor there. That was good news for the U.S. company, which makes those batteries, but it's more complicating for Boeing and the officials because it means the investigation trail expands. And I think the main problem for Boeing is that nobody knows exactly what the defect or problem is at this point.
You know, you made an interesting comparison and a little unnerving, too. You talked about Sam Verhoeven's book, Jet Age, about the British Comet that was supposed to pioneer commercial jetliner aviation. And nobody knows why, but it wasn't working.
And it's true. I mean, Sam's book, Jet Age, is a great book. He's a local Seattle person. Everyone should read it. But the just to put the Dreamliner 787 problems in comparison, the British Comet was having difficulties which led to the destruction of the plane, in-flight explosions, and people being killed. So far, of course, there have been two worrisome episodes with the 787 of batteries overheating in one case and apparently smoking and in fire in the other, but no accidents, no harm of any sort. So it's not yet anything like the scale of what happened to the British Comet, nor even the DC-10 structural problems, nor some early Airbus 380 problems with apparent wing cracks. So if this is brought under control relatively soon, which is still what most people expect, it will be viewed as a bump on the road to the Dreamliner's role for Boeing and the world's airlines. If they don't find it out relatively soon, then people can start thinking darker thoughts.
You know, it's funny. I've been listening to interviews, I'm sure, as you have too, and whenever a reporter is talking to, usually another reporter, they're saying, well, how long? How long is it going to be grounded? How long is this going to be? And nobody wants to say, because it could be months. It could be a long time, and that is a scary thought for the economy in this region, to be sure.
It is indeed, and the train of investigation on these, the reason I mentioned that the battery, ruling out battery defects was bad news, is that would have been the most easily containable problem. If you could see, you know, in the ideal situation from Boeing's point of view would be one production run of this Japanese subcontractor and saying, oh, yes, there was something wrong with those batteries. That seems not to be the case. And also, according to the Japanese authorities, the batteries themselves, beyond just a particular production run, don't have anything evidently wrong with them. And that means that then the trail spans out in a number of other directions. And aviation, for understandable reasons, has a very, very heavy regulatory bias in favor of safety and not certifying things until you've gone through the triply redundant fault paths. And so nobody can say how long this will be because nobody knows where the trail is going to lead.
We're talking to James Fallows. He's the Atlantic writer. His book, China Airborne, is coming out in paperback soon. You know, just on that note, the chairman of the NTSB said last week that neither event should have occurred on the Dreamliner. There are multiple systems to protect against a battery event like this. Those systems did not work as intended. We need to understand why. So they're digging now deeper into the guts of the electronics and the software of the plane, right?
Indeed, there should be things to keep batteries from being overcharged. You know, the most likely cause of a battery overheating is it being charged too much or too quickly, and there should be systems to prevent that. There should be the equivalent of circuit breakers to interrupt charging if there are anomalies, and then other kinds of containment systems to keep smoke from escaping, to keep heat away from areas where it can do extra harm. So, again, that's the essence of airline design, is all this sequential what-if questions. What if this goes wrong? What if the next thing goes wrong? What if all these things go wrong? And so far, there's an indication, again, not of a fundamental, structural, possibly fatal defect with the airplane itself, but with something that appears not to be as simple as most people would have hoped right in the beginning. And, of course, this leads to all the larger questions about the outsourced design for the Dreamliner in particular and what Boeing will do in the future. But right now, they're just trying to get these airplanes flying again.
True enough. And there are many a Boeing engineer in this region and many who listen. And it has been hard to talk to Boeing and the official Boeing as well as unofficial Boeing. So if there are any engineers who would like to share some of their insight with us, start with an email, weekday@kow.org, because we would like to understand this a little better, too. So you could shoot us an email, weekday@kow.org. All right, Jim, so that last question, you know, you have looked at this larger question of outsourcing, and the argument has been against it. Well, you know, it's just more control, more quality control when it's done closer to the altogether. That's been the argument of the SPIA engineers and the other workers at Boeing, and argument of people who say, look, let's keep Boeing being built in the Northwest. What do you think? Has this undermined it completely, the argument for outsourcing, or does this just mean another look at it, another layer of quality control?
I think it probably complicates what Boeing had thought of as an outsourcing model. And one thing to keep in mind is that through modern history, at least the last 30 or 40 years, first Boeing, then its main Airbus competitor, then anybody else who wants to be in this business in any way, large or small, has recognized that a reality of life is you have to spread the production work around the world. If Japanese airlines are going to be buying all Boeing airplanes, they want to do much of the work in Japan. Same for the Chinese, same for various European countries. You've discussed in the show before, a difference in the Dreamliner's case was that more of the actual design work was also done outside of Boeing's central control, which led to various integration problems, delays, incompatibilities, et cetera. We actually had in my magazine, The Atlantic, about a month ago, an article arguing that in general there's going to be return of high-end manufacturing work to the United States because of the vulnerabilities introduced by when you disperse the situation or the work too broadly, and Boeing may now have demonstrated that in a way that it didn't intend to with the delays for the Dreamliner.
Ray LaHood is resigning as Secretary of Transportation. He's announced 5 days ago he said the Dreamliner was safe. Thoughts on that and overall thoughts on 5 days before the Dreamliner was grounded, that's right. Thoughts on that and thoughts on LaHood's tenure?
Well, Ray LaHood is now at the moment the only Republican in the Obama cabinet, with Robert Gates, of course, having resigned early to be at the Department of Defense. This increases the incentive for Chuck Hagel, as a former Republican senator, to be defense secretary. It's interesting. I actually think that Ray LaHood has been one of the less noticed members of the Obama cabinet, but I think his tenure will be favorably reflected upon, in that he emphasized a lot of the fundamentals of America's transportation system, from old issues like rebuilding the infrastructure of roads and bridges to new issues like his personal crusade about texting while driving. So I say, job well done, Secretary LaHood.
Yeah, and a big supporter of high-speed rail, right, and trying to get that jump-started around the country.
Yeah, so for, I think that 4 years ago, not many people would have picked him as somebody who had achieved relatively more than many others in a fairly star-studded Obama cabinet, but I think he earns that respect.
All right, Mr. Fallows, a pleasure to talk to you again. Thank you for taking the time.
Thanks so much.
James Fallows writes for The Atlantic magazine. He's author of China Airborne. It's about to come out in paperback. And that article he mentioned about that Atlantic had about the return of high manufacturing to the United States. Pretty interesting article. That's in the current Atlantic. This is Weekday. So high-tech manufacturing comes back to the U.S., but will they pay their fair share? Does big tech that's here today pay its fair share? Not according to some. Brad Dudley writes about technology and business for the Seattle Times. And if you're like me, he's a long-time go-to columnist. Brad Dudley, thanks for talking to us.
Sure thing.
So Microsoft, Amazon, the others, they're in line, you write, for even more sweets at their annual Olympia Love Fest. What are you referring to?
Well, there's a hearing actually in about 45 minutes in Olympia where the tech industry is going to be asking to extend one of the multiple tax breaks that it receives in the state. If you're doing research and development, you can waive sales taxes on stuff you buy to do that research and development. You can also waive get a break on B&O taxes. Today they're talking about B&O taxes. I bet the sales tax thing will come up. The sales tax thing has saved the tech companies like about $249 million cumulatively over the last 8 years or so. And that number is about the same number that the state is looking to raise from other businesses and from consumers with new taxes on gasoline and beer and B&O taxes to pay for education. So I wrote a column on Monday talking about whether that's the right priority, and perhaps if the tech companies want more money spent on education, then perhaps it's time to dial down some of the tax breaks that they receive.
They get those tax breaks, we're told, because without them they would leave and we would suffer as the economy goes down. You said the tech industry's face should be Dudley Dursley, Harry Potter's spoiled cousin.
Well, that was a little bit of a joke because my last name's Dudley, but yeah, it's true. You know, when tech companies are small and starting out, perhaps some incentives make sense. The original idea behind these things was that these companies were building really complicated products. You know, the idea started back in the early 90s. You know, Microsoft hadn't even released Windows 95 yet. And you had these smaller companies that took a long time to build the really complicated thing. They didn't have any money coming in the door. So the state thought, well, let's let them hold off on paying their sales tax until they start selling these products. You know, it was kind of a good idea. But eventually the state modified that to say, well, we'll just let them not pay the taxes at all after the product is released. And also these companies got huge. And, you know, Microsoft just reported that they are making a profit, a pure profit of $2 billion a month. So they probably don't really need that hand-holding as they develop their products and release them.
Well, remind me in more specifics. What isn't Microsoft or Amazon paying sales tax on?
Well, it's specifically on activities related to researching and developing new products, or R&D. And, that's cool. You know, that's what they do. They research and develop new products. It's pretty much most of the work that they do here and elsewhere is researching and developing new things to release. So they're coming out with Microsoft's going to release a new Xbox later this year. They've spent, you know, who knows, maybe $1 billion researching and developing what that new Xbox will look like. So that's involved new facilities, new labs, things like that. A lot of expenses. Some of the expenses for outsourcing research even. And so they don't have to, and new computers for all these people working on this research. So they don't have to pay sales taxes on that stuff.
So all the basic building blocks of their business, but labor, not labor, right? Labor is not going to be included in that.
Yeah, I don't think it's sales tax. So, and, you know, another thing that's looming is Amazon is doing this huge new campus in downtown Seattle. And we don't know how much that'll cost. You know, who knows, $2 billion maybe to build all those buildings downtown. I don't know whether or not there will be sales tax on that. I think that's kind of an interesting question. You know, is Amazon going to get a waiver on that? I think that the threat of companies of that scale leaving is minimal, though. Their biggest asset is people. You know, they employ 50,000 people around here. Software companies from all over the world come to Seattle to tap into this talent pool. So it's not like they're going to up and leave, particularly because the amount of money that we're talking about to these companies is pretty small. The sales tax amount, they wouldn't even report it on their financial things to the SEC because it's a tiny amount to these guys. But to the state of Washington, it's a huge amount of money. You know, it's the kind of thing that is causing, you know, you and me to have to pay out of our pocket to send our kids to kindergarten because the state can't afford all-day kindergarten.
Well, Brad Dudley, so the Department of Revenue, as you know, because you put the link in there, puts up these lists of what these different tax credits or options are. So B&O are put tax credits, high-tech research and development spending, aerospace product design, workforce training expenditure, property leasehold taxes on aircraft facilities, aluminum smelters get in there, biotech manufacturers, semiconductor gases and smelters, aluminum smelters, equipment and infrastructure for data centers. Basically, all the stuff we've been touting is why we are a high-tech and progressive economy. They're all getting tax deferrals. So they came and they got tax deferrals and we got the jobs. This is the debate we keep hearing from Governor Gregoire and the current legislature about, are these good investments or not?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, there's no doubt these companies create lots of jobs and have a wonderful economic effect on the region. You know, they bring in hundreds of thousands of people. They bring people from all over the world. It's really cool what they've done to this area. But at some point, do they still need to have these incentives to continue researching and developing new products in Washington? I mean, maybe we should have a tiered program or something like that. Say your profit reaches $1 billion a month, you don't need the state to help you release new products anymore.
Are you in any way worried? I mean, wasn't Amazon and Microsoft both, weren't they both doing business in Nevada in part because they were avoiding some other sales taxes?
Yeah, there's a whole list you can go down of ways that companies avoid paying taxes. There was a real nice report in the New York Times last year about how Apple kind of moves things around, and a lot of these tech companies keep their profits offshore. There's all kinds of crazy things they do, and they save billions and billions in taxes by doing these international moves and parking revenues offshore and stuff like that. You know, in comparison to that, the stuff in Washington State really is peanuts. That's why it's a bit galling that Washington feels like it has to hold these companies' hands these ways. It's nothing. Honestly, if Washington changed these policies, Microsoft and Amazon probably wouldn't blink.
Well, you know, Governor Gregoire does want to raise taxes on gas, beer, and some other companies doing business in Washington. Not high tech, though. They're still exempt. But builders, bakers, restaurants, they'll all pay more for the next 3 years. $248 million under Governor Gregoire's proposal, you're right. And Governor Inslee hasn't proposed an alternative. But you're saying don't count on him pressuring the tech companies that he embraced during his campaign.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe what we should have is a special R&D incentive for battery research and development. You know, we could do a little bit of battery research in Washington State, maybe, and help the Dreamliner out.
Oh, all right. What do you think? Any prospects for the? This is basically a moral stance you're asking these companies to take, that maybe they should just be willing to pay for what they're asking for in terms of education. Any chance that they're going to respond?
You know, I have not heard directly from the companies about this. There's been a pretty good discussion at our website. You know, people are upset about it. And some people turn around and blame the teachers and say the cost of education is too high and stuff like that. To me, it's all a question of degrees. I mean, how much, you know, no pun intended with education there, but how much does the state need to help the companies out? How long do the incentives have to last? Should, you know, there's been discussion in Olympia about whether these things should expire. And actually, the credits we're talking about are expiring all in 2015. And the question now is, should they be extended? Should they be given the same terms? It just seems to me like there's an opportunity to maybe turn the dials a little bit and help the education system out a little bit.
Right. Of course, is an extension of an existing tax or a reduction in a tax break a tax increase? There's that debate. High tech expects breaks while education funding suffers. It's one of Brer Dudley's columns published January 27th in the Seattle Times. He is Seattle Times technology columnist. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Sure. Nice talking to you.
And nice talking to you. Brer Dudley, Seattle Times. Tax breaks for high tech industries. This is Weekday.
Julie Otsuka on her new novel, The Buddha in the Attic, in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
You may think that kids are just wasting time on social media, but new research suggests it can be part of education, not a distraction from it.
We can use things like how much time students spend on Facebook and what they do on Facebook to predict academic outcomes.
It's the latest in our series, Social Me, about young people online. It's next time on Tell Me More.
That's this afternoon at 1 on KUOW's second program service, KUOW2. Learn more at KUOW2.org.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine, delivering primary and specialty care to patients at Harborview Medical Center, UW Medical Center, Northwest Hospital, Valley Medical Center, 9 UW Neighborhood Clinics, and Airlift Northwest. More information at uwmedicine.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:26. Bringing daylight into the workplace in 20 minutes.
But first, a look at American history, how it affects our culture today. Since it's replete with the stories of disenfranchised people, disenfranchised women, who at some point or not assert their rightful role in society. Julie Otsuka is the winner of the 2012 Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, a 2011 National Book Award finalist, a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship. Her first book, When the Emperor Was Divine, has been translated into 6 languages, sold more than 250,000 copies. Her latest novel is The Buddha in the Attic. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
Did you ever think, as an artist starting out, that we'd be talking about the high number of sales for these books?
That's the last thing. I had no idea I'd even end up being a writer after starting out as a painter.
What did bring the transition, if it is a transition?
Failure. As a painter. I think that's,
come on, it must have been more than that. Do you still paint?
No, I can't even sketch casually. No, I know.
Really? You're like, you just can't?
It's too fraught. No, I did feel as a painter, and for a couple of years I just read, I think, to console myself. And that's when I got interested, I think, in first in the story form and in fiction. But it took a while. One didn't directly lead to the other.
How interesting, though. Some consolation you were getting from the words because you weren't happy with the...
I love being lost in somebody else's story and just forgetting about myself for a few minutes. Just that sense of immersion and just being taken out of yourself.
Sure. That's a good reason why we read, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is. That state of flow.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about... I was in reading The Buddha in the Attic, I was thinking about Ronald Takaki. And the writing he did, now I meant to make sure I had the title exactly right, Strangers from a Distant,
on a distant Shore.
On a Distant
yes.
Shore. Thank
yeah.
you. Mm-hmm. And his argument as an academic back when this book came out and his subsequent arguments were about reclaiming a history that was all around us but had been ignored, hidden, or covered up.
I mean, nobody knows. I mean, even now, I travel all across the country. A lot of kids don't. I mean, it's not mentioned in the history books even now. I mean, it wasn't when I was growing up, but that was a long time ago. But even now, many, many people don't know about what happened.
Well, so that was my question. If you had seen a change in as you traveled around,
No, I mean, on the West Coast, people tend to know. But in the Midwest, even older folks who were alive during World War II, some of them don't know. But certainly, I mean, younger kids now, they're still not taught about what happened during World War II.
Well, what's interesting about this book, and you have it in the back, is that your sources are oral histories that people had gathered.
Yeah.
Who was gathering those oral histories of these young women between the wars who came to America?
Actually, there was one book that was kind of like my Bible, and it's amazing. It's about 1,000 pages long. It was a Japanese man who was in the Seattle area during the 1950s and took oral histories in Japanese of a lot of local Japanese immigrants. And then somebody took the trouble to translate it. And it was an amazing. And I found it at, I think it was called David Ishii Booksellers.
Sure.
I had heard about this book. It was often referenced when I was doing my research, and I couldn't find a single copy in New York City. So he didn't advertise online at that point. But I was visiting, and the Seattle Library gave me a copy to look at overnight in my hotel room. And I thought, I have to get a copy of it. And they sent me to his bookstore, and he had two copies. And so that was an amazing, amazing collection.
To that end, The Buddha in the Attic is a chorus of voices. What were you thinking to do it in that form?
Well, I actually originally had tried to tell the story from the point of view of one picture bride, but it felt very flat. And I ran across so many fascinating stories in my research, and I wanted to weave them all in. And so I accidentally stumbled upon this wee voice. I saw this line that I'd written weeks earlier, which is now the first line of the book, "On the boat we were mostly virgins." And as soon as I saw that line, I thought, aha, that's a great first line. And then that gave me the idea for the wee voice. And it just seemed perfect for the material because it allowed me to tell a much bigger story than I could have otherwise.
Who were the picture brides, and how did that system come to be?
They were poor young, girls, 13, 14, 15 years old from Japan. Japan back then, 100 years ago, was a country of poor rural peasant farmers who were, most of them were landless, working for somebody else. They had heard about the good life in America. Back then, arranged marriage was not unusual. All marriages were arranged. They had corresponded. They had written letters and exchanged photographs with their future husbands, who were Japanese men who had come to America earlier in the century to work. By law back then, if you were a Japanese male, if you were an immigrant, male or female, but there were no female immigrants to start with, you could not marry a white woman. If you did, she would lose her American citizenship. So there were no women for these men to marry. So they would arrange to have these brides sent over. And so these young girls had heard about the good life in America, but the men had often lied about how much money they made, how old they were, how handsome they were. They often sent photographs of their handsome younger friends or doctored photographs. So thousands of women, many of our grandmothers came over as picture brides. For us, it's a very known story.
Is it a known story they shared?
No. We don't talk. Japanese Americans don't talk a lot about. I don't. And the reason I think they didn't share their story was because it was just their lives were so hard and so difficult and so bitter. And I think many of these marriages were not happy marriages. And these women had 8, 9, 10 children, because most of them ended up working in the fields 3 or 4 days after their arrival, often working in migrant labor camps. And we don't talk about our troubles. We don't. I think it's a culture that's very much about saving face.
Working in the fields, both an enticement and a challenge and an object of desire for all the other men who were also working all around them. In the chapter, sex is part of this book. Is that all from the oral histories? Did the initial ideas from that come from the oral histories? How women were treated and reacted and felt about the sex that was forced on them or given to them?
There actually wasn't a lot of coverage of
that
how
was,
they felt.
I was curious about that.
I had to use my imagination.
Were there inklings in the oral histories?
Very little reference, actually, to their intimate lives. Although, now and then I would find details. I also found details there were some accounts of Korean picture brides who came over under very similar circumstances, but very few of them, referred to life in the bedroom or what that first night was like. So I did have to imagine, but
it's quite graphic. where did they mostly live? Did they mostly live in the West Coast?
Yes. All of them. This particular boatload of brides that I'm talking about arrived in San Francisco and then scattered all throughout California. But there were also picture brides who went to Hawaii and Seattle as well. So, on the West Coast.
Did they have different experiences in Hawaii initially than in the mainland?
I'm not sure. I don't know a lot about, but I do know that it was, I think the hardest work you could do was work in the sugarcane fields. But you know, the brides who came to California, I mean, their lives were, you know, they were working 10, 11, 12 hours in the fields every day. And then they would come home and, you know, and they would take care of their children. So it was life. They called it double harness. So, I mean, life, it was just a never ending life of work, work, work.
Julia Otsuka's newest novel is The Buddha in the Attic. She's in town to be part of the Seattle Arts and Lecture Series tonight at 7:30 at Benaroya Hall. When you read from this, what's the reaction you get from the whites in the audience?
Oh, you know, I mean, actually, I got the idea for the last chapter of the novel from an older white woman in the audience when I was touring for my first book. And often people would come up to tell me, folks who'd been alive, white folks during World War II, after I did a reading for my first book, and they would say that they had no idea about the internment camps. And I would just think, well, really? Like, how could you not have known? And yet, these people I know were not lying. They were people who were coming to hear me speak, so I think they were already sympathetic to my story. But I thought about that. I thought, well, what would it have been like to have been a white child, you know, during the war? And one woman said, she was in the first grade when the war broke out, and when she sat next to a Japanese girl one day, that girl was there. The next day, she was gone. And she always wondered what had happened to her. So I just got to thinking about what would it be like to be a mostly white town the moment after the Japanese have left? And how would you process their disappearance? How would you explain that to yourself, to your kids?
Yeah, that's what it's called, a disappearance.
Yep.
They become like ghosts there in the end. They're gone.
And maybe they'll never come back, and you don't have to really deal with them.
Yeah, that was an interesting aspect of the narrative. Maybe they won't come back.
Uh-huh.
They did come back, though.
They did, yes.
Sometimes they came back.
Yeah.
Do you feel that this was the necessary or perhaps just inspiring precursor to your first novel?
I didn't conceive of it as a prequel, but, I mean, I think I'm drawn to stories because of the material and how I just thought it was a fascinating story. Just the idea of being assigned a mate kind of at random by the gods and making the best of that, a life with that person. But I kind of stumble into my story. So no, it wasn't a deliberate attempt to write, you know, a prequel, the first chapter.
It is pretty interesting historically, though, that hundreds, do we know how many
thousands
came?
Thousands. Well, I've seen between 20,000 and 30,000. I've seen different numbers, but a lot of, you know, I mean, I think many Japanese families have a picture bride somewhere in their past.
So if somebody like me, so if I were to ask you, how did it shape America? How do you think that shaped America?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, or how did America shape them? I mean,
that was next.
How did it shape it? Well, I mean, they were these kind of invisible people, and yet they were around. I mean, I think a lot of them were taken for granted. I think like laborers now, maybe like Mexican laborers working in the fields. I mean, there was just this invisible source of labor that was always there. And they were, I mean, I think barely, they were seen as being barely human, I think, by many people. Or you just don't see these people. You know, you don't see, you know, the strawberry seller, you know, beneath the straw hat, you know, on the side of the road. You know, you don't, they're not real. So I think in a way they were kind of like ghosts. And yet I think they allowed, I mean, they came over at a time when I think agriculture was just taking off. And they came with a lot of knowledge about farming because back then, I mean, when they came to America, they saw all this virgin land that had not been cultivated before. And back then, Japan was overcrowded already. And they had to make, you know, every square inch, they had to make something grow. So they brought a lot of farming knowledge to this country and were very, very good farmers.
When did they become, in the novel, it happens, and also in real life, when did they become less servants and more independent producers?
I think the system was really kind of against them. I mean, they were not allowed to own land, so which is why many of them were just traveling every few years. And I think the most they could rent for was 2 or 3 years, so the laws were against them. So it was very hard for them to settle down. So often they were working for somebody else, for a white person. So it was hard for them to really put down roots, and I think they had to wait until the next generation, their children, could own land. But they did. I mean, they did very well with what they had.
And the children could own land. That's right, because they were born here.
They were American citizens.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you're right about that. the next generation, what they had, what they were forgetting, what they were becoming. So how did America change them?
Well, I think they saw themselves as being American. I mean, my mother was born in this country. And I think that they assumed that this country would accept them. And I think that many of them were very shocked and saddened that they, too, would be included, you know, as the enemy when the war broke out and sent away. But, I mean, these were kids who, you know, many of them, their first language was English, or they learned English when they went to school and they identified as being American. They had no, I mean, they didn't speak Japanese. And I mean, I think many of them in the end were very embittered, perhaps, by the experience of what they went through during the war and what their families went through and just the experience of losing everything.
The first generation?
Well, the second generation. I mean, the kids. Because, you know,
yeah.
I mean, most of the people who were sent to the camps, like, they were children. There were many, many young children.
The no-no boys and girls. how do you hyphenate? Do you see yourself as a Japanese-American? I mean, what are you, third generation, fourth generation?
I guess third. My father's actually first generation. My mother's second. So I guess third. I just see myself as American. I don't really think in terms of, I mean, Asian American writer, Japanese American writer.
Well, you're put that way, right? Sometimes.
Yeah,
that's how you're pigeonholed, if that's pigeonholing.
I mean, it doesn't really matter. I guess I don't really care what I'm called. I just want to be able to write and tell the stories that I want to tell. I mean, the next book that I'm writing, I think, has very little to do with being Japanese American. It's about dementia and swimming. So, I mean, I guess I go to where my mind
really
wants to go. Yes.
Dementia and swimming.
Yes.
That arose from?
Well, my mother has dementia, and I was very interested in the early years of her dementia, how her memories of camp stayed with her till the very end. And I used to swim for years at the pool up at Columbia, and I'm very kind of interested in the world of the pool, water, immersion.
I like that. That's very interesting. I was curious about the labeling because, you know, you sit across from people and you talk to them, and many a person is rankled by a label. Some jazz players I was talking to.
Uh-huh.
They call me a jazz musician. A musician.
Oh, you know, yeah. I mean,
don't put me
writer,
in the boxes.
A writer.
Yeah.
I mean, so I happen to be writing about Japanese Americans, but I mean, I don't know. It doesn't really matter to me what I'm called.
Is it part of the necessity of reclaiming the history, though, to be who you are?
Yeah. I mean, I happen to write about, you know, what I know, what I know about my family's past. They are Japanese American. I mean, do I feel like I'm on a mission to? I think story for me is about character. It's about emotion, psychology. I mean, that's my starting point always. I mean, I don't ever feel like I have a political agenda.
You know, being that character is where it starts for you. How do you feel about the character that tells this story, which is a chorus of voices?
I loved writing in that voice. I mean, you can't say it's not really a character. It's many, many characters. But I loved it. I feel like this whole book came to me orally, very much in terms of rhythm, almost like a chanted song. And I almost feel like I was channeling these voices. It was kind of wonderful.
But every once in a while, and of course we can tell because the font changes. There is a
like
specific
slants all of a sudden.
Yeah. Is it a particular voice emerging from the chorus?
Yes.
But always a different one.
Yes. Yes. And I actually, you probably would, I don't. There are no repeated names. So it's every sentence could be a window into one person's life, and then we move on to somebody else's life.
But we as the reader will be the ones sort of creating the track, the trail across the narrative because it's a different voice emerging.
Every time,
right?
Yeah. I mean, it's the story, you know, of a people who went through a collective experience.
Julie Otsuka's book is The Buddha in the Attic. She's talking about that and a number of issues tonight at Seattle Arts and Lectures at 7:30. Thank you.
Thank you.
In a minute, we're going to find out how buildings are being designed to bring daylight into the workplace and why that matters. That's right around the corner here. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Bedrooms & More, family-owned in Wallingford on Northeast 45th Street for over 30 years, providing a selection of two-sided, flippable mattresses designed for lasting comfort. Learn more about flippable mattresses at bedroomsandmore.com.
West African nations are struggling with rebel groups and religious extremists. Add one more threat, narco trafficking. An exile from Guinea-Bissau says his nation needs outside help now.
Because we don't have the means to fight the alliance between the army and the narcotraffics. So who is going to protect you?
West Africa's cocaine connection, next time on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine. Today from 3 to 8 p.m.
Hi, this is Jack Spear with NPR News. You've heard us say it many times, and it's still true. You are the public in public radio. Everything you hear on KUOW is only possible with your support. So if it's been a while since you've made a gift to KUOW, please renew your support today. It's easy. Go online to KUOW.org. And thank you.
45 degrees in Seattle with scattered showers across the region. Rain likely through the day with a high of 46. Later this hour, we'll look ahead to the weekend weather forecast, and we'll get a recommendation for a hike to match that forecast. That's 15 minutes away.
Though, of course, how many of us get a chance to take those hikes? Because we're basically inside, right? Most of us. You and I are.
That's, well,
No, you're, what's your weather window?
Maybe there, we should remedy.
There's your weather window. There's your outside, a TV screen that shows us it's raining.
Yeah.
That's how most of us are living our lives, right? Far away from the light and the shadow of the day. Not all of us. I know many of you are right now wandering the outside, and you are lucky. But a lot of us are missing it because we're inside. We're inside these artificial buildings we built. So some architects have been thinking about maybe if we can reconnect people from the outside to the inside, we'll at least feel better about our work. Maybe we'll even pay more attention and be more productive. Christopher Meek is a research associate professor of architecture at the University of Washington. He's co-author of Daylighting Design in the Pacific Northwest, and he's also a daylighting design specialist in the University of Washington's Integrated Design Lab. And his book takes a look at some of the best practices being done to bring daylight inside.
We're just relearning the lessons that our predecessors knew when they designed buildings. They were essentially responsible for creating buildings that illuminated themselves because they didn't have the technology to do that the way that we do now. They had to think about how the shape of their building, what direction it faced, how it related to the sky and the sun, delivered light so that people could functionally use the spaces. But the advent of pretty high quality electric lighting systems and fairly low cost energy sort of freed architects and designers from having to think about those things and to sort of create shapes that maybe had meaning in ways that were important but didn't really connect to the authentic nature of a place.
That's a very nice way of putting that, what some architects might have been doing.
Right.
Some of them were unhinged from having to be central to place, and that's not always a good thing.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important things about recent developments in sort of green building. It's reconnecting to place and to our place in it and finding climate and the site and the world around us as a resource inside our buildings and to think about how we can connect to that, both to reduce the amount of energy we use, but also to create higher quality spaces that people love to be in and to do great things in.
Christopher M. Meek is a research associate professor of architecture at the University of Washington, along with Kevin G. Vanden Y. Mellenberg. They have written Daylighting Design in the Pacific Northwest. It's a UW Press book and a part of the Sustainable Design Solutions from the Pacific Northwest. What are some of the tools being used for daylighting design? We're talking about skylights. We're talking about windows.
Yeah, I think in large part, it's really the fundamental geometries of the building. If we create a building that's really wide and big and fills up a whole city block, just the nature of that shape is going to alienate a large portion of the people that are inside it from the outdoors, just by virtue of where they are relative to windows. If we create buildings that are narrow, and no matter where you are in that building, you're close to the outside, you may have access to a window or a line of sight to the outside to see whether it's day or it's night, what the weather's like. Reshaping buildings so that that relationship between the indoors and the outdoors is less distant, I think, is the biggest tool and the biggest barrier for that, because buildings that are narrow and sinewy cost more, and they don't deliver as much square footage for, you know, surface to volume ratios are lower.
Older buildings have light wells, or where buildings are built around an open central core. Is that because that's what the designers back then were trying to accomplish?
Absolutely. If you want to deliver light and air to a building's occupants, they should be close to the perimeter. I've heard those buildings referred to as alphabet buildings. And in that sense, if you look at them in plan or from above, you'll see that they look like an E or a T or a C or an O, a shape that has perforations in it to give people that access to light and access to air.
When you look at a building today, a modern building that's successful, what are the elements that they have in them? Because a lot of buildings are built very large. So are those buildings, are the buildings you're talking about necessarily, do they have to be smaller, isolated, narrow?
Not necessarily, but I think it's really important to prioritize essentially where you put the parts of the building that people spend the most time in, into locations where you'll be able to deliver daylight, deliver views, deliver fresh air, an operable window, and that view to the outside. It's really critical, and it doesn't necessarily need to mean that the building follows a formal recipe, but it certainly means that the architect, the designer, the interiors folks, the engineers think about where people are relative to that experience.
See, I thought one of the interesting things that I found out in reading Daylighting Design in the Pacific Northwest was this notion that you talk about it. What spaces are spaces that don't demand daylight because they're places where people move through, as opposed to, or maybe people need a quieter light as opposed to where they need daylight. What are some examples?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's the idea that you really allow the nature of light in space to shape how people move through buildings. For example, a lot of historic buildings, one of them that I think about is the Seattle Tower downtown, where you go into the ice cave, the entrance, that brass space, and it's very dark and very dramatic. And what happens is you walk in off the street and it might be 2,000 foot candles, really bright, typical Seattle day. And you go inside and it might be 3 or 4 foot candles, much darker, and your eyes adjust to indoor light levels. It feels dark. You go up through the stairs or through the elevator. You come out into the circulation way and then out into the office spaces. There's these big windows. And if you went directly from outside to the office, it would seem like it got darker. But as you pass through that building, through that dark space, it really prepares your eyes and your perception to see that space as light when you get to the end.
Chris Meek is a research associate professor in architecture at the UW, studying light, working on, so it's not called the Seattle Daylighting Lab anymore. What's it called now?
It's called the Integrated Design Lab, because we work on building energy efficiency and space quality and health across a broad range of issues.
Now, I have seen homes in the Northeast neighborhood where I live that are being built that are wall-to-ceiling plate glass windows. And some of those are quite exposed to the street. And also, because they are facing east and west, demand coverings over them much of the time. That seems like a misapplication of design.
It is. The notion that doing better daylighting means more glass is not an accurate one. In fact, if you use too much glass, you can add to the levels of discomfort, and you can actually add to the amount of energy a building requires in terms of heating and cooling. So it's more about the placement of that glass, its size relative to the space. It's really about the relationship between the windows and the interior surfaces of the space and how that window delivers light onto those.
So if the buildings are built that have something somewhere that I'll catch a glimpse of the sky, I'll just feel a little more settled in my space, even if it's a cubicle and I'm using artificial light to do my work.
Absolutely. I think it's orienting. Being in spaces where you don't have that connection to the outside, to the landscape, I think are very alienating in many ways.
So how many folks, you highlighted all these different architects. How much of this is going on right now, this idea of using light? I mean, I like the Shoreline Transfer Station one, for example, because a lot of these are industrial buildings.
Yeah, I tried to show a range of different building types. A lot of them are public. Most of them are public spaces. I thought what was interesting is that the nature of the daylight is very different project to project, but it all has a role that's very well thought out. I think here in the Pacific Northwest, for a lot of reasons, we're a little bit more attuned to the nature of light, and there's design firms in town that have really pushed the national conversation about how daylight sustainability on many levels brought into building design can fundamentally change the nature of our built environment, the experience of it, and in many ways its impact on our resources.
That's Christopher Meek. He's a research associate professor of architecture at the UW. He's co-author of Daylighting Design in the Pacific Northwest. He's also daylighting design specialist at the UW Integrated Design Lab. By the way, I got an email. I'm sure Steve meant artificial environments and not artificial buildings. That would suggest your building isn't really a building. Did I mean that? Perhaps artificial buildings, natural buildings? No, you're right. I misspoke. But it would be grist for discussion. Natural buildings, artificial buildings, along the lines of the Bullitt Foundation building and the like. All right. Well, that's just me maundering and meandering. Michael Fagan, how are you?
Doing well, Steve. How about you?
I'm inside, and you are going to be talking about outside, which is always, even on a wet day, sounds good when you're inside the artificial lit spaces of our modern era. Michael Fagan writes about weather and helps other people know what the weather's going to be when they go on major expeditions, and he joins us to talk about the weather and a hike for the week. Where are we hiking?
Well, we're going to Cedar Butte, right outside of North Bend. And this is a close-in hike. You could even sneak it in today if you get off early off of work. And
yeah.
It'll be light rain today, actually, so not like Wednesday's going to be heavy rain, so it'll be a good day to enjoy your building design on Wednesday. But this is a close-in hike. Numbers are low as far as mileage and so forth. 5 miles round trip, 1,000-foot gain, you get up to about 2,000 feet. So limited amount of snow, if any, on the ground. And at the top, now you're not going to get the views today, tomorrow, or Thursday. There are good views of Mount Si and Mount Tenerife. And to maximize the views, Friday or Saturday look like good days for the views. And this hike is good, rain or shine. It's a nice forest hike. And also, it's good to do this hike the next couple of days. There's a high avalanche warning in the mountains today through Thursday. So doing this lower elevation hike is good timing. And one of the highlights of the trip, when you get to the top, the USGS marker says Cedar Butte instead of Cedar Butte. They didn't have spell check back then, I guess.
I guess not. And we're all 15-year-old boys.
That's right. And also, this is Green Trails Map 206S, and you'll need a Discover Pass to park there. So there you go.
Which we should all think about, the Discover Pass, because I think there's even more talk of looking at the state parks and whether the Discover Pass is going to meet the needs of their budget funding. But that's another story. What's the weather?
Another story. You could cover that one next week.
Yeah. What's the weather? We're talking rain, right?
Yeah, we're...
Or snow.
Highs today in Seattle, 46, 47, light showers on and off. Snoqualmie Pass high, 38, 39. It's already raining up there, so that wouldn't be too pleasant to go up there. And Wednesday, similar, but rain heavy at times in the city. Highs 49, Snoqualmie Pass high 40, 95% chance of rain. So again, that will bring a high avalanche situation up in the mountains. Then it starts drying out Thursday, and then Friday and Saturday we actually get a dose of sun. So those, at this point, are looking like the two best days if you want to enjoy the views from outside and not inside.
Things rolling across us, huh? One system after the next.
Yeah, the jet stream's just aimed at us, and I know a lot of people were complaining. We had that dry spell, and sure enough, Seattleites were complaining, why is it so dry in the middle of winter? Well, the spigots turned back on again.
I would like to say for the record that I was not one of those people, Michael. I enjoyed it.
I'll second that.
All right. Michael Fagan is West Coast Weather LLC, his blog, Fagan's Weather World. And hikewashington.net suggests great hikes that you can find out more information about at hikewashington.net. Sir, we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Thank you.
And now, the sound of the day.
Paul, our listener, was walking home the other day when he stopped at a reservoir park in Redmond to take some photos of the sunset. That sound, that's him jumping onto an access lid of the reservoir with his hiking boots, and you can hear the water trickling inside the giant reservoir tank. Wow. Kaboom. What interesting sounds are you hearing or making? Record 30 seconds. Send it to us with the story behind it. Sound of the day. Weekday at KUOW.org. More weekday to come. The show produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Magano, Amin Alsade, with help from Andy Hurst, Alexandra Garrettin, and Danielle Anthony Goodwin are our interns. Bernardo Letts, the engineer, and our host for the mornings. Yes?
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Steve. It's a minute before 10 o'clock. A new report says that state policies are forcing a lot of jobless folks to pay unnecessary fees to collect their unemployment benefits. That's in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from CareSimple, providing 24/7 medical care by phone and webcam.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.